chips, and we haven't got any Americans here, have we? No, because I can't use the word crisp. I have to use the word chip if we're in the States. So crisps and chips, crisp bread, bread. And in April 2002, one Saturday morning, I opened my newspaper and there was a whole page article with headlines like this: cancer linked with crisps and chips, cancer threat to the snack food industry. And it wasn't something that was just disappeared overnight. It became a very big issue. And what had happened was that in Sweden, they had published on a website an observation that this chemical compound, acrylamide, was found in baked and fried foods at quite high levels. I put there 3,000 parts per billion, 3 parts per million. Now, chemicals in food at levels of 100 parts per billion, 0.1 part per million, we start to worry about chemicals coming from extraneous sources like pesticides and other places and perhaps packaging. So something at 3,000 parts per million. So, of course, the initial headlines were this was the evil food industry. The evil food industry was adding this chemical to the food. Well, we very quickly realised that wasn't the case. But this is for the chemists around, it's a very simple molecule. It's an amide, as shown by this part, and it's got a double bond on it. And that's acrylamide. It has been known because it's an industrial chemical. It's quite widely used as an industrial chemical for polymerising. The biochemists use this compound extensively because the means of separating out different proteins and separating out DNA use a polyacrylamide gel to do it. So anybody who worked with it knew that there were possible problems. It was a neurotoxin, and it had been investigated in the 1980s and judged to be a probable carcinogen on the World Health Organization scale. So that's quite a risk. And this was because it was known to be carcinogenic to laboratory animals. And the evidence coming out of Sweden was that this was being found in those crisps you've all eaten, but also in bread and in coffee, a number of different foods. Just paused a moment there, because you think, well, Sweden, yes, a very developed country, but why did their food science community pick this up? Why hadn't it been picked up in the States or the UK or a bigger country in Europe? And there was a group in Sweden who were interested in the toxicology of industrial chemicals. And they had been looking at the chemical acrylamide being used in the building trade, in organisations that polymerise it to give polyacrylamide. Polyacrylamide is used as a flocculant in water processing, in the water industry. So they were interested in the workers that were using it at an industrial chemical. And there was the Swedes were then building a tunnel, a railway tunnel, and through the hillside, through a big hill. It was going to be a 3-4 mile long tunnel. And they had great problems with water seepage in this tunnel as they were finishing it. So they used acrylamide and polyacrylamide as a grout, as a sealant for the tunnel. It was then noticed that fish in the water that was running, in the streams that were coming off this hillside, were dying. Cows were getting sick. And so the Swedish biochemists then started to look at the tunnel workers, and they found that very definitely tunnel workers had got acrylamide in their bloodstream. They were also suffering from neurological problems. The ends of the fingers were going a bit numb. So because they were good scientists, they did a control study. And they looked at a control group of people who were not tunnel workers, hadn't worked, not working in industry. And they found These people had acrylamide in their bloodstream. Such people like you and me. So then they separated out smokers, because acrylamide is in cigarette smoke. So they separated smokers and non-smokers. And non-smokers still had this chemical acrylamide in their bloodstream, albeit at extremely low levels. So then the question is, where did it come from? And they thought about water supply, they thought about cosmetics, exposure to industrial chemicals, and diet. And they found, so they analysed then a whole range of foods and found this chemical compound in a range of different foods. So this wouldn't matter at all if acrylamide hadn't been designated as a probable carcinogen. We certainly don't want probable carcinogens to be in foods we're eating every day. And these are just some facts, and you've got them in front of you, about the sort of levels that you need in animals to cause signs of cancer. It's very difficult with any chemical to prove that it's a cancer in humans. I don't think we'd be very popular if we divided this room into two groups, and one of you we fed acrylamide to for a year and the other side we didn't, and see whether you get cancer. You know, you can't do that with humans. Correlate it back to animal studies. And animal studies, the levels are 1,000, 10,000, maybe 100,000 times higher that are fed to animals than we would get in our diet. So how do you bridge the gap? Also, laboratory animals live for 2 years. We hopefully live for 80 years. And how do you work that one out? And this is a very big problem. There's been a lot of work done in the States using epidemiology. And there you look at a group of people. And this group at Harvard University had access to records going back for 25 years of nearly 100,000 people who for various reasons had been in studies, and they had recorded their diet and any illnesses were recorded. So it's a lovely set of group of people. And then they looked at the diet of these 100,000 people over 25 years, looked at the records and divided them into categories. People who would have low acrylamide, therefore probably didn't drink much coffee, no crisps, no chips. Five different levels up to high acrylamide, where, you know, they're eating chips and fries a lot. And then they looked at the incidence of cancer in those five groups. You'd think with 100,000 people, there would be some correlation. There was none. There was no correlation with most of the cancers they looked at. More recent studies from the group have suggested there may be a link with ovarian cancer and cancers of the uterus, which are quite, well, I wouldn't say they're rare cancers, but they only represented a small number of people within the group, and there was some suggestion that acrylamide might be associated there. But when I spoke to the person who was heading this group, I said, well, what sort of number of people do we really need to observe? And she said, oh, 1 million, 3 million. So it shows the problem of trying to relate cancer in animals to the effect of those similar chemicals on us, who have, for the most part, very varied diets.
Is it worth mentioning the study that was done on the Chinese?
Right.
I think there were sort of 4,000 Chinese workers with acrylamide who were studied. You probably know more about acrylamide.
I probably don't know that one, but were they exposed in...
They were actually in production
processes. In production processes.
And they found over quite a long period no statistical difference between them and the population. But they did then extend the study and found that in the decade following the end of the study, they got a greater incidence of pancreatic cancer.
Ah. But, That's.
I think that's in the WHO.
Yeah, I don't remember that particular one because at one time I was looking for exactly the sort of thing you said. Has anybody? It's all right. Looking at the overall population and trying to get it for how much is in our food.
I saw it in the WH study, I saw it in more paper, so it must have been the WH.
Because they'd done a lot. But of course, the levels that they're exposed to in industry are so much higher.
Indeed. And of course, mechanism
of absorption is different. So they're so much higher, it still gives us that issue. How do we relate it back to very small doses over a lifetime? They were on relatively high doses. And certainly, the only thing about that, if you look at the data on people exposed in industrial circumstances to acrylamide, they will show those signs of neurological damage. But that will they recover. It's not a permanent. So if they're removed from the source of exposure, then they recover. So on that side of it, that's positive. But all this means that we can't, as a society, as a food industry, neither can government, ignore the fact that a carcinogen, however we measure that carcinogen, or potential carcinogen, is in foods that we eat all the time. Inevitably, therefore, the chemists, first of all, start to say, well, where did it come from? And what was observed was that we required relatively high cooking temperatures. And myself and a colleague at Leeds, we looked at the structure of acrylamide, as I show you there, and the structure of an amino acid, simple amino acid, asparagine. And you can see I've highlighted there the relationship between the two. And so we deduced that the asparagine was probably giving us acrylamide.
When you say high temperatures, how high?
Over 120.
And would it be linear or asymptotic?
It's fairly linear up to about, I haven't got the slide here, but up to about 160, then it drops off in a model. So if you heat asparagine and the other thing you need is a sugar. I think I said there, you need a sugar as well. If you heat asparagine and a sugar, you will initially find it goes up almost linearly, up to about a temperature of 160 degrees, then it starts to drop off. And the same happens in certain foods, in coffee. Coffee undergoes a very rigorous roasting process. Mild roasted coffees have more acrylamide than severe roasted. Now, I've just said temperature is incredibly important. You need a high temperature. So wouldn't you expect coffee that was cooked for a long time, roasted for a long time at a high temperature, to have more than coffee that was roasted at a mild temperature? But this molecule here, this molecule acrylamide, is quite reactive. And what happens is that it is reacting, so some of it's disappearing. While you've still got lots of asparagine in your food, it will continue to generate acrylamide. Once the asparagine's gone, then you don't get any more acrylamide generation. But it's the other point on this, though, is what sort of foods is it found in? And if you look down that list there, these are all carbohydrate foods. We don't find much in meat. And really, up to 2002, every problem the food industry had was to do with meat, whether it was BSE or whether it was foot and mouth or almost anything. And, you know, we've still had it recently, haven't we, with horse meat. And meat was the area where always got the problem. And meat, we didn't find it in meat. Potatoes were products were probably the worst. Note, though, and that comes back to your point about temperature, boiled potatoes, you won't find any acrylamide because they don't go above 100 degrees. You need dry conditions and loss of moisture and therefore a higher temperature. So it will be formed on the outside of bread crust. It will, but well, those crisps that you've all eaten, there are not many left. Those are thin slices, they all get to relatively high temperature. Okay, so these are snack foods. We ought to be eating less snack foods anyway, shouldn't we?
Would toast appear on that list?
Sorry?
Toast.
Toast, at that time nobody had looked at toast, but toast will. And overcooking a piece of toast, then you're going to get more acrylamide. Probably because you don't get rid of all the asparagine. Yeah, so the more you cook it, the more acrylamide you'll get there. So yes, toast could be an issue. No, but I don't know whether anybody's done since. One thing, I digress, and I've finished my 20 minutes that I should have used up, but I've used it all up. But we did, a few years ago, some work on baked potatoes, and this was the most depressing experiment that I did. We baked potatoes in the microwave, and we baked them in the oven. Now, hands up who prefers microwave-baked potato? We all want oven-baked potato in their jacket because the skins. The highest levels of acrylamide we found were in the skins of those potatoes. I still eat baked potatoes, but not every day, because they're exposed to the high temperature of the oven, that in order to get the whole potato cooked through, you need the surface to get very hot. And probably the sugars and the amino acids that are needed to make, as you'll see in a minute, to make this compound acrylamide readily are in the skin and migrate to the surface. So that was depressing. But you see, also, we all... crisp breads. What healthier food could you have in crisp bread? Yet that caused enormous problems because we had high levels. But if you think about a crisp bread, then they are very dry. They've been heated to quite a high temperature. And so, and bread and coffee. Depending what country you go to in Europe and the rest of the world, you'll find that the proportion of the diet, the acrylamide, in relation to food, some countries, then the biggest risk is coffee because they drink a lot of coffee. Others, it's fried potato products. Others, it's snack food products. And there have been surveys done on that. But why? Why then is this compound acrylamide found in these plant-based foods and not animal-based foods? Well, relatively simple answer. That asparagine is essential to plants. It provides a source of nitrogen. So a plant, when it grows, needs to have, think of a potato, the little shoot coming out of the side of the potato, that needs to develop proteins in order to grow. And to get the nitrogen for those proteins, it uses asparagine. It uses asparagine that's stored in the tuber. And the same is going to apply to wheat seeds and barley seeds and cereal seeds, that there you have relatively high levels of asparagine to help that plant grow when the seed or the potato germinate. So that's why it's in plants. So it's a very natural thing to be there, and certainly it was nothing the food industry was putting in. But on the chemistry side, which is where we came in, why is it there? What is happening? And for many, many years, we've known of a reaction called the Maillard reaction. 100 years ago, a French chemist, Louis Camille Maillard, was looking at the reactions between the relationship between amino acids and sugars, and found that if he warmed glucose with a very simple amino acid like glycine, it went brown. And he deduced that some reaction was occurring. And so in the food industry in the 50s, when it noticed browning in a number of dried foods like dried milk powder, then they attributed it to a reaction between amino acids in the food and sugars. In cooked foods, this Maillard reaction is responsible for the nice flavours, the nice colours that we get. And again, for the chemist there, the two reactions are very... A sugar breaks down in the presence of amino acids, and you get some simple sugar breakdown products. These will react with any amino acid to give us various flavour compounds and some colour. If the amino acid happens to be asparagine, it's acrylamide. So the reason for this, forget about the chemistry, but the reason for this is showing there's a direct relationship between the formation of flavour and the formation of acrylamide. So how did the food industry approach this? Now, I think, and I'll mention this a couple of times probably before we finish, the food industry has been extremely responsible for this. They joined together right at the beginning. So you had the likes of Nestle and Unilever, PepsiCo, United Biscuits, all sharing information because they were so concerned that this wasn't something that was just their problem. It was no use PepsiCo finding a solution to acrylamide in food because they'd have to share that with everybody else. So the food industry has worked together extremely well. But what sort of approach could you take? And as a chemist, I could look at this and say, well, what we need for acrylamide is we need some sugar, a reducing sugar, so that's glucose or fructose. We need an amino acid. We need heat and the loss of water. So we need to lose water, we need to put heat in, and we need to lose water. We get an intermediate, or a number of intermediates. They can react with asparagine there, the amino acid asparagine there will get acrylamide. If other amino acids will give us flavour and colour. So, how could we inhibit this? Well, an obvious way of inhibiting it would be to try and reduce the amount of sugar and perhaps the amino acids, and in particular, reducing the amount of acrylamide, of asparagine. If there's less asparagine in the food, you're not going to be able to get as much acrylamide. But the other one is, what about this step, this processing step? If we put less heat in, or maybe cook things at a lower temperature, will we be able to prevent the formation of this compound, acrylamide? And so this was the initial approach industry took. Could they modify the time and temperature of cooking? And I know the crisp bread industry did a lot on this because they were using quite a high temperature in their ovens. And they had a series of ovens because crisp breads have very low moisture. They're very stable. You need to have low moisture. But the process for getting low moisture was giving the characteristic flavour, colour and also the texture. But what they did, they said, well, can we effectively use lower temperatures in the ovens? Maybe pass them through the ovens for longer, keep them in the oven longer, but keep the temperature lower. Would that reduce it? And I think, I don't think I'm speaking out, I think some of them introduced the idea of using a microwave step to try and get rid of the moisture out of the product using microwave. You still need the heat, the temperature, the baking to get the flavour. But not. So that was an approach. Other, could you get rid of some of the precursors? And the other way is everything these days, if you go into nutrition and food science, antioxidants are the solution to absolutely everything. You know, they will prevent heart disease. They're very important in the diet. But also we try to look at the role of antioxidants, whether antioxidants would inhibit this reaction so that we didn't get as much reaction occurring. One very interesting approach to trying to remove the precursors was to say, if we could get less asparagine there, we're going to get less acrylamide. It's the starting material. If you have less of the starting material, you get less of the product. And somebody worked on the idea of using an enzyme, asparaginase. An asparaginase breaks down asparagine, so it's no longer to aspartic acid, so it can't give acrylamide anymore. And so two of the big enzyme companies now market enzymes to add, and it's a naturally occurring enzyme, comes from yeast, and they put that into the fermentation step and therefore reduce the amount of the asparagine that's there. But is there another approach? What about thinking about the plant itself? Can we effectively give a plant that has less asparagine and therefore will give us less acrylamide? There are lots of implications of that, because I said at one stage asparagine was essential for plant growth, but there may be other approaches to that. And two areas that we've looked at, because I've done quite a lot of work with the Rothamsted Research, who are up at Harpenden. They're the UK's biggest research institute looking at cereals and crops. We looked at some on fertilisation, but also looked at trying to see if we could find different varieties that would have lower acrylamide. Because you can't say GM at the moment. A few years you might be able to use the term genetically modified, but at the moment it's not an approach. But understanding something about the genetic, what genes will promote asparagine and which will inhibit asparagine is important. This is an interesting one on fertilizer, because this has implications for the environment anyway. It's been noted that if you have a low level of sulfur, of sulfate in the soil, then you get very poor yields of wheat. Here's some wheat without sulfur in the soil, with sulfur in the soil. And you can see they show the difference in yield, and there's some numbers to go with that difference in yield. So we had a look at the asparagine levels in some of these wheats, and here are the three varieties. And we were amazed to find something like 40 to 100 times difference between plants grown on a normal soil with sulfur and plants grown on a sulfur depleted soil. And you might expect that this big difference would then result in big differences in acrylamide. And surely enough, much more acrylamide in those, as you'd expect from those plants with low sulfur compared with high sulfur. So we ought to be making sure that the land that grows our wheat has got enough sulfur on it. But this isn't something that just came out of the acrylamide story. This has come out of issues on plant and on yield from wheat. Some of us here are old enough to remember smogs and the presence of sulfur and soot and everything in the atmosphere. Even then, and we also know, of course, about acid rain and how that was causing great problems to forests. But acid rain and sulfur in the atmosphere was having a long-term beneficial effect, because that sulfur eventually went into the ground. And therefore, levels of sulfur, in the form of mainly of sulfate, levels of sulfate in the ground were relatively high. But since we have cleaned up the air, and we don't put sulfur into the air anymore, that isn't a source of sulfate in the ground. And this is a map that was drawn up by the Homegrown Cereals Authority, showing areas of the country, where those marked in red, where there was a depletion of of sulfur. And some of these, especially in this area, are in our wheat growing areas. So that one recommendation to the farmer would be: make sure there's enough sulfate in the ground, not only because that will give you a better yield on your wheat, that will also give you wheat that will give less acrylamide when it's used in products. And I mentioned at the beginning, or I mentioned a few minutes ago, how the food industry has worked together. And companies have, now, they haven't shared everything, because no businesses are silly enough to share everything. But they have shared an awful lot of information about the approaches that should be taken to lowering acrylamide, and they produced this toolbox. Much of the data from the toolbox came from the larger companies, but the idea was to provide information for small businesses that wouldn't be able to do their own research. And so that is published on the website, and the information is freely available. And it gets updated every 2 or 3 years. So that is an example of how the industry has approached this and has tried to act, I think, responsibly. And this is some very recent data that is just about to be published of some the food industry providing myself and my colleagues at Rothamsted Research with data that they had obtained over the last 10 years. And they had, over that time, analysed 45,000 potato crisp samples. And up to this point, they'd all kept that information to themselves. But they decided they were willing to share it. And so they provided us with all that information. The only thing they wouldn't tell us is which data came from which company. So we got a mass of data, 45,000. And we were able to look at that over this over the period from 2002, when acrylamide was first announced, up to 2010, last point we had the data. And there is a very definite, the positive thing is there's a very definite trend downwards. And I think this is because the industry has taken a lot of time and a lot of trouble to try and look at every stage of the process, raw materials, how they process the raw materials, how they finally heat it, how much they heat it. Now, that is probably a good news, bad news picture. The good news is it's dropping. The bad news is that it's still there. And personally, I don't think we'll ever get rid of it completely. I offered several companies a total solution to acrylamide. And that was, stop frying and baking your products. Let's just boil. So only eat boiled potatoes. Don't know quite how you deal with bread in that way. You certainly can't have any coffee, but maybe coffee. Clearly nobody was going to take that up because the heating of foods is so important for the flavour quality. But it's also important for the textural properties. And you can't eat bread dough. Just mix flour and water. Very difficult to digest. You do need to put heat into food. And we all like the flavours of these cooked foods. So I've put this, I think that's probably in the handout. So really saying this is a very big problem in food science. It's had probably more attention than any other single subject, certainly in the area of food chemistry, over the last 3 or 4 decades, I would have thought. It's something that the industry is still working on. Government is continually monitoring and asking for lower levels. At the moment, government hasn't put any actual restrictions on the amount that might be found in a food. So I went on a little bit longer than I thought, but do you want a break?
I think that sounds like a good place to stop and we'll carry on the discussion afterwards. Thank you. So bring the hat round, refill any glasses with whatever we've got left, and then we'll have a chat in a few minutes.